This is Canopy Conversations, where we take you behind the scenes at Canopy and share insights from our team. I'm your host, Eric Schwartz. We've got a really special episode today. I'm pleased to welcome Tom Davis, Canopy's newest general partner and head of our San Francisco office, which, truth be told, is an office of one, at least as of mid-May 2024. But Tom, thanks for joining us. Great to have you on the pod.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be at Canopy and thrilled to be on the pod. Feel special to be a guest.
Well, truth be told, we have all of our GPs on the podcast, so we're not prioritizing you or making you feel too special. But we love doing these sessions as a way to help kind of go behind the scenes and uncover who we are as people, not just as investors. And I think it's really important that our LPs understand, and portfolio companies for that matter, understand the people and what makes Canopy special. You are born and bred in San Francisco, one of the few folks that I've come across, not the transplants that now live in the Bay Area, but truly, you know, bleeding the 415. So maybe let's start talking about how growing up in the Bay Area shaped your career path.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I'd like to thank you for calling San Francisco, San Francisco. The people come in and call it Frisco or San Fran, but for anyone listening, San Francisco's the way to go. I think San Francisco is such a unique and interesting city. It's obviously had so many eras over the time period, from kind of the 60s and 70s to kind of the dot-com boom of the 90s. But it's always been this kind of boom and bust town, really, even going all the way back to the 1800s and the gold rush. And I think that's in a way what shaped my excitement for innovation and being an investor. It's such an optimistic place. It's this small little city. It has a lot of risk. It has earthquakes that could happen at any time, but the city always kind of finds a way to rebuild. And I think in that sense, I always found innovation, entrepreneurship, and optimism, coupled with kind of this view of it'll get better, to be really something that I thought would be a pretty cool part if I could go be an investor. So I think certainly growing up in the city, being around that, particularly in the 90s, when you saw so many of these incredible companies coming out. I mean, we were early adopters in our household of Webvan, if you remember that company. Sure. That was really the earliest grocery delivery company. So I think it's hard if you grew up in the city in the 90s, you know, to not kind of feel the excitement around what entrepreneurship and innovation is.
You know, you talked a little bit about the history of San Francisco. You kind of fast forward to today, or even the past 5-10 years, that the city's, you know, been in the news for not always the best reasons, going through some tough times. What are your thoughts on long-term future for the city?
Yeah, I think, you know, the city has gone through a tough period, as many cities did the last few years. I think, unfortunately, San Francisco has been slower to rebound when you look at other cities, whether it's New York or Boston or LA. And part of that is just that, unfortunately, the best part of the city, which is the tech community, has still not kind of returned to work. And so the downtown area kind of hasn't come back that strongly. I think, you know, with that said, I'm incredibly optimistic for the long-term future. I think that when you look at the city and you look what we have, which is this kind of ecosystem and flywheel of a couple key things. One is really the education system, University of California, which you have UC Berkeley, you have UCSF here in the city, which attract tremendous talent for their undergrad and grad programs. You obviously have Stanford, which has that as well. But most importantly, you have all of these large companies. If you go back to the 70s, 80s and think about what really happened in technology and Intel and Hewlett Packard and Gordon Moore and Moore's Law and all of that, that really was the first generation and the earliest VCs who seeded so much of this. And so many of these big companies kind of came about. It really started in Silicon Valley because they needed the space. They were building hardware and they needed to develop silicon. That obviously moved to San Francisco as kind of tech made sure we don't need as much of that hardware. But what's really interesting to look at is in every era, you have certain behemoths of companies that have developed. And to take the most recent examples, whether it's Google, now Alphabet, or Facebook, which bought Instagram, or you go back to the Intel and HP, all of these companies have hired hundreds of thousands of people. And those people have done largely really well because they learn a lot, they work at these companies. And then the companies kind of become legacy businesses and people get bored and they maybe get some wealth through the stock options, but they've developed their life in San Francisco. They've had their kids here. They've built community here. And by the way, it's a lovely place to live, as everyone knows. It's got the Napa Valley an hour away. It's got Pebble Beach and Carmel. It's got the Sierra Nevadas and Tahoe, and of course the Pacific Ocean. And so you have this community that's evolved, and people aren't leaving. And then you see it now with the Open AIs of the world, or the Stripe of the world, the Collison brothers coming over from Ireland, obviously PayPal, really one of the earliest fintech companies. So you have this incredible ecosystem of people who've grown up with these big companies. They've done well. They leave. Their communities are here. They leave the companies and they start new companies. You're seeing this with OpenAI. Just
Sure.
yesterday, the co-founder of OpenAI resigned. He's the big joke around town last night at a dinner thing I was at was how many term sheets he's gotten from Sequoia and other people not even knowing what he's doing. So that system, I think, will be incredibly hard to break. Similar to DC, by the way, and what you have there in politics and regulation, similar to what we see in New York in banking and everything else that goes on in New York City. I think these world-class cities where that flywheel gets going, it takes a lot to break it. And I think you're seeing that next iteration of it now with an OpenAI and ChatGPT, which is taking over all sorts of subleases in downtown SF, hiring, rumored to be hiring 50 people a day right now. And that's probably the next wave of it.
Well, you've done an amazing job of, I guess, having a side gig on the Visitors Bureau for San Francisco for hyping the city. I'm booking my ticket after we hang up because it's so much to look forward to, and the weather's great, but the energy, I agree, is pretty
Well,
incredible.
and we what you know what we what I do with some of our people and other entrepreneurs when they come out here is after we meet or we have dinner, I ask them if they've taken a Waymo, which is a self-driving car. They inevitably say they haven't. I pull up my app, I put them in a Waymo, and Waymo is Alphabet's kind of self-driving car. It's now throughout San Francisco, and it's amazing to be in it. It's a wonderful car. It'll drive you anywhere. Smooth experience. But I always tell people, you come to San Francisco, you will feel energy and innovation. So it's so exciting to have. Be opening this office and have, you know, people coming out and see that every day.
Well, let's talk about investing
Yeah.
and love the tourist visit, but at the end of the day, we're investors, and you spend almost your entire career as a growth investor, working with growth companies, starting at Morgan Stanley and then General Atlantic, and most recently as a partner at Centana. What drew you to growth? Why growth of all the places where you could spend your time and build your career, advising and investing in growth stage companies?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question. I've often thought about it because in college spent my time teaching. Actually, I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and I was getting my public school teaching certificate in Maine, and I went in and worked in Boston doing teaching in the summers. And then a friend of mine who I played soccer with said, "Come work at Morgan Stanley. You're going to really love working with these different kind of companies." And I think that's what I found. I went to Morgan Stanley, and we worked with a lot of really interesting at the time specialty finance companies pre-financial crisis that had probably too much growth. If you talk about growth, it wasn't great to be a mortgage lender growing back then. But I got totally hooked by entrepreneurship and the people building these companies. They were wonderfully optimistic. They were leaders in different ways. They had interesting personalities, and they were building companies that were changing things, changing the world, changing industries. And you know, look at what we do here in investing, you know, in fintech. It's changing the way that financial services operates, which impacts everyone. And I think that was really it. I got lucky. My boss at Morgan Stanley left Morgan Stanley to go to General Atlantic to run their financial services group. So I went with him at the time. And when I got to GA, which was really one of the original growth firms, you know, at the time buyout was really busy, you know, busy and interesting in 06, 07. Everyone was leaving Morgan Stanley to go to big buyout firms. And I thought that's not very fun to kind of go in and cut costs and figure out how to get returns with balance sheet manipulation. I want to put capital in to expand internationally, to build new business lines, to hire more people. And I think that was really, you know, we go back to what I said earlier about that kind of San Francisco optimism. I think that's what excited me. Was really around that stage of company and saying our capital is being put to use to hire, to develop R&D, to go to new geographies, and then, you know, hopefully we can help those companies manage the execution risks of that growth.
So over the 20 years or so as a growth investor, I'm sure you've learned a couple of lessons. What stands out as, key things that, especially as we're looking to deploy capital in a growth strategy here at Canopy, that you'd want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is just the importance of people. And I think, that's something we talk a lot about at Canopy in our
Sure.
culture. And I think we look for that in the companies that we invest in. And that starts with founders and management teams. And I think that's always been the belief, particularly when you're a minority growth investor, you head into the relationship. You can't change the founders. You're backing them. That's what you have to believe in. And so that creates a culture of partnership and collaboration. And I think that's my biggest lesson, is you have to feel like that's there and in place before you invest. And it's so one of the reasons we talk a lot here, it's critical that we know the management teams and we know the space well before we make the investment. It's why it's so wonderful with our alliance that we have the opportunity to invest with them and kind of say, hey, founders, you should talk to these banks. And the banks get to give us feedback. This is what we think about the company. This is how they handled the POC process. This is how they handled us. This is what we think of the technology. You have to do all that. You can't just meet a founder on a Tuesday and invest in a Thursday. And that's what I loved about growth, is it really was a relationship building process. And you got to then see over time how the company performs. Does the performance of it match kind of what the projections were going to be? And so that part I really enjoy. And that's my first lesson, is where I've gone wrong, which I've gone, as any investor has gone over the years. It's where I kind of didn't know the management team. I didn't build that rapport, that relationship, and I probably knew it in hindsight, looking back. And that caused friction throughout the investment. That caused us to not be aligned on exit strategy, or not be aligned on unit economics or cash burn. And that's so critical at growth, because unlike really early stage investing, which I'm not good at and haven't done a lot of in my career, you actually have proof points at growth, and you have the ability to go talk to customers, and you have the ability to see how founders have made decisions. Where do they allocate capital? So to me, it starts with the management team. I would say the other big lesson is the end kind of market that you're going after. Is it a big enough market? And are you able to kind of envision a big market? So many things, if you think about Airbnb, they totally made the market bigger. Uber, same thing. There are a lot of people who said, I'd never take a taxi. And then you put them in Uber, they said, this is amazing. Uber expanded the market. So it's not as simple as just saying, what's the market today? It's saying, what could the market be? And that's a lesson I've learned. Sometimes I've been co too constrained in saying it's actually not that big of a market. And then you have the Uber type example where the product's just that good that it expands the market. I would say that the last piece is around the business model, which is, it's really hard to transform business models at the time that growth investors invest. So we typically would say a growth investment is 5 to 7 million in revenue. By that point, you have customers, you have churn behavior, you have cohorts you can analyze. And most importantly, you have customers that you can talk to. And so stick to your instincts and stick to your gut on how that's going, and invest behind a model you can see, is my other lesson. Because if you think you can kind of transform the model, it can happen, but it's really hard to do once the company culture's at scale.
All makes a ton of sense. I know we've talked a lot about these points during investment committee, and you hit on some of them last month at the Canopy Alliance Summit when we walked through the growth strategy, and Jeff talked about the venture, that early stage strategy. Thinking about our approach to growth investing, we're deploying Fund Two, really excited about the capital that we've raised. How are you thinking about that? And maybe just a quick recap on some of the thoughts you shared with the group that was with us in New York a few weeks back.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I joined Canopy is because we have such an amazing platform. And I had known Jeff for many years, and looked at a lot of the great investments that he had made, and thought, what a cool thing that I could kind of have someone who I've seen, talk about having a relationship with and getting to see how they've been friends with. We batted ideas back and forth and got to see kind of, this is what the fund is doing at the early stage. How do I kind of bring a good approach for a different part of our capital base on growth? And I think really the biggest thing on that is being kind of disciplined and thematic in how we approach sourcing our investments. There are so many venture-backed companies, and by definition, many of them won't do well. That's great. That's part of venture. Go back to what I said earlier, taking risk. We want to do that. But you could spend your whole day kind of sifting through hypey venture companies or reading TechCrunch and things like that. And I think that's why it's so critical that we do the work that we do with the Alliance, to kind of hear what our banks are seeing, where they're worried. You think about Island and where we thought in cybersecurity. That was a lot of the great work that our team had done, in Lulu and Richard and others, kind of thematically looking at cyber, meeting a lot of companies, talking to our CISO council, and hearing where pain points were. That's exactly how we won the Island deal. You look at who's in that, and then you hear Mike Fay talk about the different wonderful things that we've done and been able to help with, and our LPs have been able to help with. That's the model, which is be thematic, figure out a way to make a difference, get into the best companies. You know, that's something I'd like to replicate. And I think you have the time at Growth to do that. We are hiring some more people, so we'll have some more of those sub verticals to talk to. We have some more really good VC portfolios to cover. And you know, you think about our offsites, and when we get together, that's what we're talking about, which is where are the areas we want to be? How do we put the right people against them? And then how do we kind of sell the Canopy story, which in many ways is the easiest part at this point, because we have a great brand. It's a large part of why I decided to come here, because I do think to win in growth equity, you just simply the next 10 years have to have a differentiation, which I believe we have because of our alliance and because of our vertical focus. So that's just some of the ways that I've tried to kind of take the lessons of what matters and then bring that in and say to people, here's where to focus your time, because we care about management team, business model, TAM, and we care about really being able to add value. Put all the other noise aside. Don't worry about chasing the high-flying names that you're reading about in the paper. You're going to miss some deals. All we need to do is a few really good growth investments a year, and we'll be in good shape.
Going off script for just a second, you talked about you've been in growth for a long time. Thinking about the types of deals that you went after and eventually did at Centana, but approaching founders now wearing the Canopy jersey, to what extent does the alliance and the platform that we have here change the narrative, change the discussion, change the engagement from founders relative to some of the other platforms you've been on earlier in your career?
Well, you know, you can't see us on podcast, but you could see it that I'm smiling right now, because that has been the best part of joining. I feel like my job got so much easier, and I kind of wonder how I did it before I joined, because when I'm out talking to founders or talking to other VCs or sharing the story, you can see people light up immediately. And the way that they respond is not just lighting up. They automatically have thoughts about people they want to talk to that are in our alliance, ways that we can make those connections, ways that they've tried to kind of get into banks that they're struggling with. I think it's been absolutely wonderful. And, you know, it feels like in the early days when I was at GA, there weren't as many people doing growth. And GA is a fantastic firm, one of the first to do growth. And when you talked about General Atlantic, one of the things they had early on was they actually had a presence in every country. And everyone wanted to go global, and globalization was really big, 06, 07, 08. Not that it's not now, but that was when it was really taking off. And I always felt like, aside from just General Atlantic being a great firm, great reputation, good people, that global presence lit people up, because they thought, I could sell this product globally. And oh, you have five people in Brazil, or you have five people in India, you have connectivity there. I feel that same energy today when I go out and talk about Canopy with people, and they say, wow, these are your investors, or you know that person at that particular bank. I've been trying to talk to them, or I've been trying to think about the right way to sell it. And so I think it's absolutely an amazing platform. It brings me tremendous kind of energy and joy each day that I head out to do my job, to talk about, you know, what we get to do, and then to actually follow through. I think so many firms say they have connectivity, but, you know, credit to our alliance and our CISOs and all of our LPs, you know, they actually follow through. When we send a survey out, you know, our people are doing that, and we can share those results with companies, you know, 2, 3 days later. That's completely differentiated. I don't think there's really any comparison. And I think it puts us at such a competitive advantage the next 10 or 15 years, where everyone has flooded growth, because growth has been a great asset class. There's been tremendous returns in growth. When you look at endowments and pension funds, you know, that's the reason that our job is harder now. There is a lot of capital. So to answer your question, it's been tremendous and really fun for me, and kind of brings me back to the early days of when I was a GA, feeling like I really had an amazing platform behind me.
Amazing. Well, we started off talking about San Francisco. I want to come back to San Francisco for a minute. Some may say that you are a fair weather fan, a bandwagoneer, when you talk about your love of San Francisco sports. So I'd love to play a little game called Golden State Warriors Trivium. And I've got four questions for you, and we'll see if you are truly, in fact, a Warriors fan. And these are all questions from before the Steph Curry era. So if you just started following more recently, something tells me we're going to out you. All right. So question number one, which number one seed did the Warriors upset in the 2011 playoffs?
So I believe that that was the Dallas Mavericks, and now I think I'm right about that. So I'm gonna kind of break the
Final
mold here.
answer?
That is my final answer. And am I correct or not? And then can I
You
expand on that?
are correct.
Okay,
So
great.
your fandom is still strong.
Okay, well, I kind of now entering the territory of don't sell past yes, because if I'm, I should probably just move to the next question. But I do remember that era really well. I believe it was the era of Baron Davis, and I believe that the phrase for the team was "We believe."
That's
And
right.
I did go to many of those games. They were in at Oracle Arena. The place had a decibel level that I don't think will ever be matched. Sorry to the Madison Square Garden people out there following the current New York Knicks run. Go New York, go New York, go, I think is the phrase for them. But yeah, that was an amazing era that we believe set off obviously the next era of kind of Steph and Clay and Draymond. But yes, that's my final answer.
Correct. So, question number two, who is the only Warrior to win the NBA dunk contest? Not once, but twice.
Yeah, Jason Richardson, amazing kind of windmill dunk at one point. I could still picture it well, just an incredibly strong, tall guy.
Correct. All right, so you're two for two.
Okay.
Number three, the number 42 hangs from the Chase Center rafters. For which all-time Warriors great was this jersey number retired?
Yeah, I'm gonna give an answer that like I don't even think it's correct, and I'm not even sure he played for the Warriors, which is Al Attles.
Unfortunately, it is Nate Thurmond.
Ooh.
All
Ooh.
right.
Tough.
Two for three is not too bad.
Okay.
Now let's see if we can at least go above 500. Last question. What are the names of the high scoring trio formed in the late 80s, early 90s, collectively known as Run TMC?
So this is a both showing my age and dating me a bit, but this is an easy one, which is Chris Mullin, Mitch Richmond, and Tim Hardaway. And I'll ask again, is that correct? And I'll give a little bit of color on that.
It is absolutely correct. Three for four, not too shabby.
Well, that's great to hear. 75%. If we kind of have all of our investments return that'll be
I was thinking the same.
a good thing. So we'll take that number. But I was going to say, a little known fact about Chris Mullin is that he's now actually back in the Bay Area, a great St. John's player. Actually, I think went and coached St. John's for a bit, I believe, but that also should be fact checked. Or Rutgers, one of those two. We're gonna have to look into that.
Yeah.
But he's now actually back in San Francisco. He is the pregame and postgame play-by-play kind of analytics person for the local TV station, and his ratings have never been higher. He's wonderful. And he's in and around the Warrior organization. And it's really fun to watch him because it does bring me back to seeing him play. If you
Yeah.
remember, he was a lefty and had a pure jump shot, which I think he still has. And for all I can tell, he's been great at mentoring Steph and Clay as they've been here. Although I don't think they needed a lot of mentoring with their jump shot by the time they
No.
shot. But yes, those were the great days of Run TMC and taking Bart over to Oakland. And I miss Oracle. Chase is a great stadium. Downtown San Francisco, a little bit emblematic of the rest of SF, kind of fancy and very tech heavy. But I miss the Oakland arena days. Those were real good days.
Well, certainly proven yourself to the rest of our Canopy colleagues that you're not a fair weather fan. Congratulations. I've got one more San Francisco question for you. I was watching a YouTube video with my daughter the other day, as one does, because we can't watch normal TV. And we were watching this video about why the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge is orange. And I figured I'd throw that out as a native San Franciscan. Why is it orange?
Huh. Well, so I don't know the answer to this. I think I know the answer because I have thought about this a lot. I believe it has something to do with the paint color being the least likely to rust given the fog and wind coming off the Pacific. And I believe they basically paint the bridge all the time. They start at one end, they go to the other, and they go back the other way. I believe that is the color history.
That is very, very close.
Okay.
One quick clarification. So as we learned from this video, apparently the bridge was supposed to be painted a variety of different colors, including at one point like stripes and what have you, so that to your point, ships will be able to see it with the fog and everything coming in and out of
Okay.
the harbor. What happened was when the steel came in from the manufacturer, it was coated with this anti-corrosive paint
Yeah.
that the architect liked well enough. So he decided, you know what, we're going to keep it this orange color. And to your point now, it's constantly repainted the same color. But it was almost by accident that that the Bay Bridge is or sorry, Golden Gate Bridge is orange.
Well, that's great. Now I have a couple of trivia questions for you.
Oh boy.
And the obvious answer is Marin County and San Francisco County, but do you know the two points at the Golden Gate Bridge? When you come off the bridge on either end, do you know that the two points that you come off into, and the interesting fact about both of them?
Is Golden Gate Park on the San Francisco side?
Well, similar perhaps to my answer, you're close, but there's a little nuance. So that we'll get
Okay.
into that. And then what about the other side?
I couldn't even fathom a guess.
Okay. Well, so on the south side, you're cor not correct, but mostly correct that actually the road does feed into Golden Gate Park, but it stops first in the Presidio of San Francisco, which actually was an army base when I was growing up here. It was a fully functioning army base in the 80s. You would go in and there'd be drills and be a 5 o'clock cannon, and it actually had an airstrip as well, right under the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
Nowadays, as part of the base closures in the early 90s, it shut, and now it's actually one of the most visited national parks in the country. Which is fascinating. It transformed the entire thing, all the housing, everything. It headquarters of Lucas Films has been there for a number of years. My older sister lives there. There's wonderful old kind of beautiful housing that you can lease from the National Park System from the government. And part of it is cheating. That's the most visited because people drive through it to get to where you are as they head to Golden Gate Park, which is a little south. So you have the federal land on that. Almost turned into a massive development of 100,000 people and saved actually at the last minute by a group of San Francisco donors who donated the money to save it with the goal that it would be kind of self it'd be able to self-run within 8 or 9 years, which it did. So now it's kind of a self-running national park. And on the other side is a state park called the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which for anyone listening, they should visit. It has the most beautiful views of San Francisco, and you can hike all the way up to Stinson Beach and Point Reyes in that area. Now I have a question for you, which is, do you know, because since you brought up Golden Gate Park, do you know the interesting fact about Golden Gate Park relative to Central Park in New York?
I'm gonna have to say either it's larger than Central Park, and/or it was also designed by Olmsted.
So the first one you just nailed right away, which no one nails. It is a larger park than Central Park. It's a massive park, so large it has bison and buffalo roaming in parts of it. The second one, that's a good guess. I don't know who designed it, so it's possible that Olmsted did both,
Yeah.
or it could be someone else. We'll have to perhaps cover that on the next podcast.
I look forward to it. And thank you for turning the tables on me and interviewing me. I'm glad that I got at least 30% right, which again, venture returns, not too shabby.
Yeah, pretty good. I agree.
Well, Tom, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Really appreciate the time. Wonderful to have you as part of the Canopy team.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the podcast, and so thrilled to be here, and so thrilled to meet so many people kind of in the coming months and years. Appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Canopy Conversations is confidential and may not be relied upon as investment, legal, or tax advice. Please carefully review Canopy Connect terms and conditions for further information.